about science, different kinds of things we went over in chapter 15. We talked about the banyan tree. So those are the things I hope we remember something about from chapter 15. So the last two verses of chapter 15, they talk about something very interesting, that knowing Krishna means knowing everything. Here is text 19, chapter 15, text 19. Whoever knows me is the Supreme Personality of Godhead without doubting, is the knower of everything. He therefore engages himself in pure devotional service to me, O son of Bharat. I'm just going to read both of them, and when we read today's chapter, we'll do it the normal way. This is the most confidential part of Vedic scriptures, O sinless one, and it is disclosed now by me. Whoever understands this will become wise, and his endeavors will know perfection. So, one who knows Krishna knows everything. That may seem a strange statement, but actually, without understanding God, you can't make sense of anything in this world. In one place, Krishna says that this material nature comes from me. In another place, he says, it is like pearls strung on a thread. So, we have a necklace. There's a thread that goes in between all these. What happens if you pull the thread out? All the beads just go all everywhere to it. And that's exactly what happens when you try to understand this world, but you leave God out of it. Now, we're going to be talking about that in a minute, because in chapter 16, it's called Divine and Demoniac Natures, and Krishna contrasts people who have a divine outlook on the world and people who have a demoniac outlook on the world. Since most of the Gita he's talking about devotees, devotional service, consciousness, he doesn't spend much time talking about the devoted people. But he hasn't spent much time talking about demonic mentality at all. So now in chapter 16, he kind of really expends some time and some effort in describing what a demonic person is like and what makes them demoniac and what the outcome is of a demoniac outlook. So here in this chapter we find that everything is resting on Krishna, like pearls are strung on a thread. What do you say? What do you say? What do you say? Sutra Mani Ganahi is the Sanskrit. Verse, and I think it's the fourth verse.
Shasti Dhananjaya
Maya Sarvam Idam Prottam Sutre Mani Dhanahiva. O conqueror of wealth, there is no truth superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. You see that? So here Krishna is saying two things, that there's not something that's even more important than him, like the Brahman or some other such thing. And then he says, everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. And we all know that if you pull the thread out from the pearls just fly every which way. And what's interesting, we live in a culture and in a world now that is more and more predominated by the so-called scientific view of things. And to be more exact, there's a book I recently come in contact with, which describes an outlook in the world called naturalism. And that sounds very nice when you first hear about it. Maybe we're talking about living naturally or eating good stuff, but that's not what it means. In this case, naturalism is a scientific term, and it means that science studies only those things which are nature and nature alone. There is nothing beyond nature. So in other words, in the naturalistic science outlook, means we cannot talk about God, because God doesn't exist, or even if he does, he doesn't matter. And the only thing that does make sense and does exist is matter, various types of it and how it interacts with energy and so on and so forth. Those things we're happy to talk about. But there isn't any of that voodoo stuff. And this is called naturalism. The appeal to nature. Nature is the ultimate thing. And what happens when you have that outlook is just like you take the thread out from the pearls, everything starts to fall apart. And most people who are atheistic and materialistic will not understand that things are falling apart. And as a matter of fact, to them, it looks like things are going forward. But to someone who is connected to Krishna, they can see that things are not going forward, they're falling apart. And so that's why what happens when you yank God out from under everything is, A, the world stops having meaning. And we start to have only the meaning that men or people give to the world. And that is arbitrary and it seems superficial. And the meaning I give to the world may be completely different than the meaning you give to it. And suddenly we're in a world that everybody has their own sense of meaning, and there's no unifying elements to it. And when we have a world that has different meanings to different people, how can we talk about laws? You know, how can we talk about what we should do? Because the world has different meanings and different values to everybody. And suddenly ethics implodes and morality begins to become completely ill-defined. Now, if we look around the world, we see that exactly those things are happening. You know, that everything is becoming less and less black and white. Nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows what they should stop doing. And morality has become a guesswork. The laws themselves are starting to get very strange and convoluted, and sometimes they appear to make no sense. And people have no ability to actually understand why they're alive. And so people throw themselves into sense gratification. Some people do. Into, you know, drinking and eating and being merry. You know, some people do that. Some people throw themselves into intoxication. They get really wrapped up in either some kind of dope or some kind of alcohol or something like that. That's how they do it. And other people just build a fantasy world that they live in. Because when you pull Krishna out, when you pull the string out, the whole thing collapses. You know, no longer can you build a world where I have some understanding that's similar to your understanding, and therefore we can have a society, we can relate to each other, we have the same standards. Now, everybody has different standards, and people find it hard to relate to one another, and we can't build laws very easily because everybody's arguing about what they should be all the time. And that's the world we live in. And that's the world that naturalism brings to us, because naturalism is another synonym for atheism. We don't accept God. Rather, we only accept what science can prove. It's naturalism. And sometimes that can also be called humanism. There's another thing called humanism. Humanism means that we have morality. We want to be moral, but we don't want to talk about this God business, because that's what always gets us in trouble. The problem is, when you talk about morality without talking about God, morality also becomes very wishy-washy and hard to talk about. And it becomes so relative that after a while we can't even pin down what morality is. So there's another problem. And because once you rip a person out from under the floor of everything, then everything begins to collapse and there's nothing you can do about it. And again, those people who are theistic and understand the importance of God, they can see something serious is missing from our social view of the world. And most people don't have it, so we have a lot of serious problems. However, atheistic people will be completely blind to it. They will not think that anything's missing. As a matter of fact, they'll feel a joy in their heart that things are finally going forward to become, you know, the world we should have been all along, the brave new world created only by man. And so we're going to be talking about that a little bit today, but I wanted to jump off from it, from the last verses on chapter 15, because in chapter 15 we talked about how the banyan tree, we had pictures of it. You know, I gave you a picture of it. You saw it in Cheshire the other day. So we've talked about this big banyan tree that's all convoluted. It's hard to see where it comes and where it goes. And that's this material world. The material world is designed to be confusing. And the only thing that gives it sense is if you accept some kind of spiritual doctrine and you begin to understand the world through the eyes of the spiritual view. And of course, if your spiritual view is very dogmatic and narrow, you won't get a very good picture, but at least you'll get some picture. If your spiritual view happens to be the Vedic system and the Vaishnava tradition, you'll get a very clear and very expansive view of why this world is the way it is. You've got something coming out of the back there.
There's a couple of trees in there that need.
Talking about chapter 15 last week. So, science is lost in this banyan tree. You can never investigate things enough. We do know a lot of things, but our knowledge is like Swiss cheese. We know some things, and we don't know things right next to them. So, although yes, we do know some things, there's a lot of stuff we don't know. So, we can never get to the bottom line of anything with science. Our brains are too feeble to be able to take it all in, digest it, and then come up with an understanding of it. Even scientists themselves, they try to do it by using computers. But of course, they're not sure what it is the computers are telling them. You know, when you're standing on a ladder, you're already kind of off base a little bit. Now, if you balance a chair on top of the ladder, then you're even more precarious. And now maybe you've got a stepping stool on top of the chair on top of the ladder. You know, you get farther and farther away from stability, from anything you can relate to, and you're not sure what you're talking about anymore. And that's the way science has gotten. It's hyperinflation. It's making all kinds of claims that actually cannot be realistically supported by any kind of scientific evidence. So it's become philosophy in many places. And not even good philosophy. It's become really patchy, funky philosophy that is kind of, you know, poorly constructed. So the banyan tree will bewilder us. But if you understand Krishna, you have the basics. You know that it's supposed to bewilder us. And we know that the material energy, if we take it for what it appears to be, will become lost in it. But if we take it for Krishna's energy and we try to use it for Krishna, we won't become lost in it. We'll know the right thing to do with it. And we'll eventually get knowledge from within that you cannot get by doing scientific experiments. Let's move now into chapter 16. And chapter 16 is called Divine and Demoniac Nature. Get a chance to make up any quantity of these this week because my printer was doing crazy things. Yeah, divine and demoniac nature. There's our guy there, and he's got a little bevel on one side, a little hard on the other side. This is an important image. I'm going to pass this around. There's a bigger version. Staircase, and you can either go up or you can go down, and these are the things that bring you down, and those are the things that bring you up. Staircase. And toward the end of this chapter, we're going to be talking about lust, anger, and greed. And this is the image there, three gates leading to hell. Each one of them represents one of them that's greed, that's lust, and that's anger.
This is in this chapter too.
Yeah. We won't get there today, but we will be talking about it.
Next
weekend
is really interesting.
What's that?
Next week we're going to be talking about this.
Yeah, lust, anger, and greed, right? So this is going up to the spiritual world or down. That's what happens when you go down. This is Maya offering all kinds of things. And as you go down, you become more and more covered by ignorance, envy, lust, anger, and greed, and fall down into darkness.
Wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Kind of a scary picture, but then the world we live in is scary if you don't know what you're doing.
Sometimes even if you do know, it's scary.
Yeah. So let's look at chapter 16 called Divine and Demoniac. Put these pictures away for now. One of the things I wanted to bring back from chapters 15, which we did last week, is confidential knowledge. We said that confidential knowledge means that we know that we're not the body. That's where confidential knowledge starts. And when we talked about more confidential knowledge, what is that? Remember?
As we know there's a God, there's some kind of higher power.
Right, we know there's something. We don't know what it is yet. But we know that not only are we not the body, but there's something behind the universe. It isn't just a dead bunch of matter clumping together, bumping around in random ways. There's something behind it that's more confidential knowledge. And most confidential knowledge is what?
We know there's God, there's Krishna.
Yeah. So that's most confidential knowledge. And we see that in this world, most people don't even have confidential knowledge. We have to speak of more confidential knowledge. most people don't even know they're not the body, what to speak of there's a higher power, what to speak of the fact that that higher power isn't a power, it's a person, it's Krishna. And Krishna has created a world in a certain way, and if we want to connect with him again, we can do that, and then we can get lifted out of the material world, especially this dark material world. So that's confidential, more confidential, and most confidential of all. So Krishna starts off chapter 16 by describing divine qualities. Even though it's called divine, divine natures, he starts off with divine nature. So here's Krishna's list of divine qualities. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, fearlessness, purification of one's existence, cultivation of spiritual knowledge, charity, self-control, performance of sacrifice, study of the Vedas, austerity, simplicity, non-violence, truthfulness, freedom from anger, renunciation, tranquility, aversion to fault-finding, compassion for all living entities, freedom from covetousness, gentleness, modesty, steady determination, vigor, forgiveness, fortitude, cleanliness, and freedom from envy and the desire for honor. These transcendental qualities, O son of Bharata, belong to godly men endowed with divine nature. So this is Krishna's, you know, Christmas list of things that we should be striving for. And if you are in the divine camp, or at least you consider yourself to be, you should be saying, do these qualities manifest in me? Do I have some of these qualities? Or am I at least starting to build up these qualities? So that's Krishna's list. And we see all kinds of important things are there. Fearlessness, purification, charity, culture, spiritual knowledge, study of the Vedas, austerity, tranquility, compassion for all living entities. These are things that we would naturally expect to see in people who are genuinely godly. So, let's move on. You can read the next one. What is it that Krishna contrasts to the not-so-godly?
Pride, arrogance, anger, harshness, and ignorance. These qualities belong to those of demoniac nature or son of water.
Yeah, so we see how this is a different group of characteristics. And when we see these characteristics, we can wonder, it's easy to tell the people from the black hats and the people with the white hats. So, we can get an idea there. Pride, arrogance, conceit, anger, harshness, and ignorance, these are qualities of the demoniac. Krishna's going to speak a lot more about it, but he's just saying that for right now. Because
transcendental qualities are conducive to liberation, whereas the demoniac qualities make for bondage. Do not worry, O son of Pandu, for you are born with divine qualities.
Yeah. So, here we find transcendental qualities are conducive to liberation. Demoniac qualities actually make you more and more bound. What do they make you bound to? They make you bound to materialism. They make you bound to illusion. They make you bound to the body. They make you bound to the cycle of repeated birth and death. All these things are the things that you will be glued to if you're cultivating, instead of divine qualities, you're cultivating demoniac qualities. And in this verse, Krishna says, don't worry, Arjuna. You are born with divine qualities. Now, we can ask the $64,000 question here. So what are we? we divine qualities or demoniac qualities?
Just a mix, maybe?
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. That in the age of Kali Yuga, it isn't like all the people with the black hats are on one side of the line and the people with the white hats are on the other side of the line. We are mixed qualities. And that's why we're fighting a battle between ourselves. We have qualities that are divine and we have qualities that are demoniac. And that's why we're learning what these qualities are. And we're beginning to recognize what qualities we want to hold on to and what qualities we want to get rid of. So it's said that in the Satya Yuga that all the divine entities lived on certain planets and all the demoniac entities lived on other planets. Then in Treta Yuga, all the divine beings lived in one certain countries and the demoniac ones lived in other countries. Then in Dwapar Yuga it said that sometimes we see that even the divine qualities were in one family and some of that same family were demoniac in quality. And in Kali Yuga we see that even in the same person we have some divine qualities and some. So it's much more diffused out now. You know, it's not like in Krishna's time or in earlier time, it's possible to fight a war against all the demoniac people and kill them all off or something like that. Because in Kali Yuga, everybody has a combination of divine and demoniac qualities. In fact, when Lord Chaitanya was going to kill Madai, or Jagai actually, he was going to kill Jagai, Nityananda stopped him and said, "Don't you remember, Lord Chaitanya, that in Dwapara Yuga, as Krishna and Arjuna, you did take a battle against the demoniac people. But in the age of Kali Yuga, everybody's mixed, so if you're going to kill Jagai, you basically have to kill everybody, because everybody has some demoniac quality in there." Of course, Lord Chaitanya didn't accept that argument. He was still going to kill Jagai, but Nityananda came up with a better argument that actually stopped him. That's another story. But we see that in the age of Kali Yuga, because so many people have a mixture of divine and demoniac qualities, we can't just do some big military battle and kill off all the demoniac people. Instead, we have to do it a different way. We have to give people knowledge and kill off the demoniac mentality, not the demoniac so-called people. So, in this age of Kali Yuga, that's why we spread the chanting of the holy name, because Chaitanya and Nityananda came to start a process that was very easy, a process that was simply joyful, that by chanting we can get rid of all our demoniac qualities. We don't need to take up swords against people, or lasers, or AK-47, or whatever we want to use in the modern day. So that's why I wanted to bring that out. Don't worry. Arjuna certainly was in divine quality, but we can't exactly make that same claim. But we are at least understand the importance of purifying ourselves, so we're on the path to being purified. And we shouldn't think in terms of, well, all those people over there are demoniac and we are so holy. That's completely wrong thing to think. It's even a bad way to think in Dwapara Yuga, what you speak of Kali Yuga.
Matt saying, you would contradict a couple of these qualities if one say that.
Yeah. You have to see how many of those you actually have. And then, you know, when your report card and you look at it deeply, you think, well, maybe I've got some distance to go here. I'll give myself a maybe E for effort or something. I'm certainly not here yet. Okay, so Fred, you can read the next one. Six, I think.
O son of Prita, in this world there are two kinds of created beings. One is called the divine and the other demoniac. I have already explained to you at length the divine qualities. Now hear from me of the demoniac.
So now Krishna's giving us a short course on evil. On what you shouldn't do, or what you shouldn't be like here. And this is interesting, because we're going to be talking about this today. This will be the main focus of what we get into. And so here's verse 7. Those who are demonic do not know what is to be done and what is not to be done. Neither cleanliness nor proper behavior nor truth is found in them.
They say that this world is unreal, with no foundation, no God in control. They say it is produced of sex desire and has no cause other than lust.
Following such conclusion, the demoniac, who are lost to themselves and who have no intelligence, engage in unbeneficial, horrible works meant to destroy the world.
Taking shelter of insatiable lust and absorbed in the conceit of pride and false prestige, the demoniac, thus illusioned, are always sworn to unclean work, attracted by the impermanent.
They believe that to gratify the senses is the prime necessity of human civilization. Thus, in the end of their lives, their anxiety is immeasurable. Bound by a network of hundreds of thousands of desires and absorbed in lust and anger, they secure money by illegal means for sense gratification. So, now we're starting to get a fairly complete picture of what demoniac life looks like. I have a list of some of these things here. Not know what is to be done, what not to be done, not clean, not behave, not truthful, say the world is unreal, the world has no foundation, say that there is no God, the world comes from lust and sex only, engage in unbeneficial, horrible works, endanger the world. Now, this doesn't take much, expertise to look around. And I just jotted down some of the things I consider unbeneficial, horrible works meant to destroy the world. And we see these everywhere. Here's my short list of unbeneficial, horrible works meant to destroy the world. Nuclear energy, invasive medicine, invasive electronic surveillance, fracking, fossil fuel exploitation, geoengineering, genetically modified organisms and food, pesticides, animal slaughter, HAARP, heart, biowarfare, economic manipulation, forced immunization, fluoride and medical amalgams, pollution, population control, factory farming, invasive government, irresponsible manufacturing, waste disposal problems, ozone layer depletion, extinction of species, war, abortion, and the Codex Alimentarius.
Those are good. Really good ones.
So
that's not all of them.
Well, that's not all of them, right? I mean, that's just kind of touching the iceberg. But we see these things all around us. So how did it get this way? Why is it this way? Because the people who are running the world are godless. That's one of those. And they don't feel they are obliged to anyone or anything for why they feel they need to do what they do. They think that God is dead. And they think that there is no God. So we are the only people that decide what the world is for and how to run it. And since we actually are leaders or wealthy people, we're in control of things, we matter. And people who don't have any wealth and don't have any control over things, they don't matter. And we're going to run run the world the way we think it is, because there's no God, and we're the ones that decide. We can decide, and we have the money to decide, and we have the political position to decide, so hell, we're going to decide. And that's why the world is the way it is. And, of course, those people who are blinded by technology and science, they think there's something wonderful about, you know, the fact that we can come out with a new iPhone every 5 or 6 or 7 months or whatever it is. They think that's amazing, you know, that, you know, we have faster and faster jets, we have better military technology than we had before, that now we've learned how to manipulate genes. A lot of people think this is all wonderful stuff, but there's a lot of people who don't think this is such wonderful stuff, that in fact they look at the downside of all these things, which are the opposite things. How our dependence on fossil fuel has created pollution holes in the ozone layer, created oil spills, created this whole system of fracking where our groundwater is being poisoned and cities are collapsing into holes and things like that. And we begin to see that this technology, without any understanding that it's part of a larger ecological system and that there's a God underneath it and needs to be thought about, not just that because we can do something scientifically, we should blindly just go ahead and do it and not worry about what happens until after it's happened. This is a crazy idea. And this helps us to get a handle on why things are as off as they are. Of course, it's quite likely that things won't go on like this for very much longer, because things are pushing the envelope and something is going to crash somewhere. How it will crash is anybody's guess, because it can crash in a number of different ways. But the fact is that the way we are looking at things now, it can't go on this way for very much longer. We are making too much of an impact on the environment in the wrong way. Our economic system is completely out of control. Our governments are getting more and more invasive and, overstepping their rightful authorities. And at some point, this will lead to a serious breakdown. And so we should understand how and why this breakdown will happen. It will happen because people are becoming more and more godless. At least those people who are running the show are becoming more and more godless. Of course, we understand that God is in control of everything, including the people who think they're in control of everything. And so there's always some way to connect with God no matter what happens. That's always possible in any circumstance. And those who make an effort to turn to God, especially when things aren't so bad, then they'll be able to turn to God when things get worse, if they do. Whether they'll get worse all over the world at once, or whether they'll just get worse in some places and not in others, or whatever it is we can say, that we can't say. But we have to be aware that we have to practice connecting with God, so that if the chips get down, we'll be able to not only help ourselves, but help people around us. Because if the chips go down, most people are going to lose them. There's just no way around it. You know, that people aren't thinking about the world or how it's going to go or any of those kind of things. And most people are not really based in either religion or atheism or anything. They're just floating around in this nice, happy soap bubble of material happiness, with some material miseries thrown in. They think everything is nice, but when the soap bubble bursts, they'll realize they have nothing to grab onto at that point. It's only the fact that we're working to connect ourselves to God. It gives us a platform. It gives us that string within the necklace that holds everything together. And we can hold things together, and Krishna will help us to figure out how to get through the situation. But if we don't have any of that, we've made no practice, we've made no effort, then we'll just feel like a soap bubble tossed in an angry ocean. We won't know where we're going to wind up. And And over more and more, we begin to see that the leadership of the world is completely out of touch with reality, and that it seems to be completely out of touch with God. You know, of course, in America, our country was founded on the idea that no one religion should rule, which is not a bad idea. That's a reasonable idea. However, it's been more and more misinterpreted to mean that religion should not be in politics, which is a completely wrong idea. And if you take religion completely out of any kind of government, then you have atheism, and then that government will have to collapse. There's no possibility of government. Now, government shouldn't favor any particular religion, but they have to foster religion, and they cannot go to bed with atheism. It just won't work. And that's, in fact, what is happening to our government. On the plea of wanting to be neutral to all religions, government is actually shutting out every form of religion and making a happy playground for atheists, because atheists will never be accused of siding with some religion, because they're against all religions. So atheism is quite at home in politics. Whereas if you have a religious faith, it could actually be used against you in politics. So naturally we see that government is drifting in the wrong direction, not only in America, but it's been in the wrong direction in many other places in the world for a long time already. There are a few places in the world where supposedly some kind of religious idea is there, but most often it's very crude, very fundamentalist, very fanatical kind of religion, so it doesn't help much. But at any rate, this idea of unbeneficial, horrible works meant to destroy the world is what we're seeing plenty of right now. And the reason, of course, that people don't see it, and that the main leaders are encouraging it, is because they're completely demoniac and completely cut off from God. And the leaders are more and more basing what they want and need to do, not on any religious ideas, but on scientific ideas. And science has for a long time been saying that naturalism is the way to go, that we don't need to talk about God, that actually there's only nature, we don't need to think about God, and as humans, we're the people that decide everything. So, I'm going to stop there and ask you all if you have any questions.
Okay.
Okay.
I see what you're saying, because in schools, public school now, there is no talk about God.
Yeah.
So they came up with all these schools that have different names, like my son goes to school, but it's called IB school.
IB?
Yeah, and they have these values and principles, like integrity, telling the truth, which is basically what religion teaches.
Yeah.
And that's supposed to be a good school because it has those things in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But even that, I feel like the kids are not going to, why would they answer to that? Right?
Yeah.
The fundamental question, why should we be kind to each other? Why?
Right.
It's going to work for some time, but unless they have faith, they're not going to. In high school, it's going to go out the window.
Well, if you truly believe naturalism, you truly believe science, then there's no reason for morality at all. There's absolutely no reason for it. That why shouldn't the most powerful get what they want? I mean, if there's no God, there's no karma. There's nothing happening to you after you do whatever you do. If you're powerful and wealthy, why shouldn't you do what you want? You know, people may not like it, but who the hell are they? You know, but when you have a religious understanding, you understand that there's somebody who's watching it all, and what you do today, you will be held accountable for it sometime in the future. Maybe not today, but at some point you will be accountable for it. And so therefore, maybe you ought to consider how other people feel. And when we understand God and we want to develop love for God, then naturally we want to develop love for other people too. It isn't like you can love God and hate everybody else. So all these things make sense when God's in the center, and none of these things actually make sense when you rip God out from other things and pretend he's not there.
still care about
right,
the
right.
issue of morality.
Well, there's a nice book that Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote. It's not a big book. It's called The Tattva Vivek. And in that book, Bhaktivinoda Thakur discusses all the philosophies of Earth, and which is pretty ambitious project. But he starts off by saying that there is Vedic philosophy, which he calls Astika philosophy, and there's non-Vedic philosophy, which he calls Nastika. Astika means, it is so. In other words, the Vedas are so. Nastika means it's not so. The Vedas aren't what it is. And he talks about, basically, you have theism, and then on the other side of the coin, we have various flavors of atheism. Now, atheism doesn't come in one flavor. It comes in a number of sub-flavors, just like Baskin Robbins. So, there are different flavors of atheism. Now, some atheists are hardcore, we should enjoy. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has names for these things. I don't remember what they are right now in Sanskrit. But, those people are usually few and far between. Those kind of atheists that feel that since there's no God, why does it matter what anybody else feels? It matters to me what I feel because I directly experience it, but what other people feel doesn't matter to me because I don't experience it and it doesn't matter to me. So that's probably the lowest form of atheism. And that kind of atheism is practiced and preached by certain people, and of course very wealthy, powerful people naturally believe that because they have no reason not to believe it, and nobody can get in their face and tell them that what they're believing is completely wrong. So most people believe a more moderate kind of atheism, where they believe that there is no God, but we should still be kind to one another. So that means I want to enjoy in the material world. I'm still a materialist. I want to enjoy. But I don't feel good enjoying if I know the person next to me is miserable because I'm enjoying. So that's a different kind. It's still atheism. It's still materialism. I don't believe in God. But I want to enjoy in such a way that my friends and neighbors can also enjoy. People on the other side of the world who are at war with us, I don't care about them. They can all be killed off. Not that I don't care about. But all my relatives and friends and people I live with, I want them to enjoy too. So as long as it doesn't cut back on my enjoyment too much, I don't mind if other people enjoy too. So that's a more tempered or a temperate form of atheism. And it shows a person hasn't sold out to materialism quite as heavily, but it's still materialism, it's still atheism, and people in that category will do all right to a certain extent, and that's what we call humanism, where humanism is this idea that we should be moral, and people matter, and other people's feelings are important, and class struggles are real, but God isn't. Such people are called humanists. We get in trouble when we talk about this God business because then your God has to fight my God and we get our AK-47s out. So let's leave God out of the picture. Let's just talk about how humans are in need, how some people are poor, how some people are oppressed, how some people are in class struggles, and how I can enjoy and you can enjoy and we can all be happy, material, bunnies all the way around. That'll make everything work out. So that's called humanism. It's a branch of atheism. It's not as hardcore as the Charvaka atheists, which are the first kind, where I'm going to enjoy what I want to enjoy, and whatever happens to you, I don't give a crap. That's hardcore atheism. This kind of atheism also doesn't help because when push comes to shove, if your humanism is not based on God, then at a certain point you'll think, well, times are tough, I don't mind. find other people enjoying if it doesn't hurt me too much, but now it is hurting me too much. So I better just keep what I need and whatever else other people need. I'm not really so hot on that right now. I just got to stay alive myself.
What's that? I have to look out for myself.
Right, right. So that's what happens to that kind of humanism when push comes to shove. And then the other thing that happens with humanism is that we can't decide what it is that's really good for people. A lady comes up to me on the street and says, "Can you spare some change so I can get some cigarettes?" Now, she wants cigarettes. I can give her some money, she'll go buy cigarettes. The cigarettes are killing her. She doesn't know or doesn't care or can't stop the cigarettes. I'm giving her money to help her kill herself. Is that a good deed or is that a bad deed? You know, when we talk about humanism, you can't decide. You know, most humanists would say, get her the cigarettes because she wants them. And, well, it may kill her, but that's what she wants right now. In other words, what she wants right now is more important than the fact that it's going to kill her in the long run. Because what's important right now is more important than the overall picture. And that's why humanism starts to break down. Now, we get into more tricky territory when we start exploring the idea that what if I do something against you but you never find out about it? Then have I harmed you? Because everything's based on what humans think and feel. There's no God anymore. And there's no religion or books or anything like that. So everything's based on what humans feel. Say, I'm having an affair with your wife, but you never find out about it. So therefore, you're happy. Your wife's happy. She's having relations with two different men. I'm happy. Everybody's happy. So where's the harm? The only harm comes if he finds out about it, that fact that I'm having an affair with someone else's wife. That's where the problem is. So then it's no longer a question of right and wrong, but a question of getting caught or not. And morality begins to get so wishy-washy and soggy around the edges that we no longer are able to make any decisions. What if I go out and I start having sex with a young child, and the child says, I like having sex with this old man? Then, essentially, we can say, well, the child wanted it, the old man wanted it, so it should be okay. But we can also say, well, wait a minute, how does the child know what he really wants at that age, you know? And so, right away, humanism starts to hit the, you know, heavy mud of relativity that you can't get out of anymore. Because everything depends on what people think. And today, what people think may be okay. Tomorrow, maybe they'll think it's not okay. And people who are doing the wrong thing will rationalize that the wrong thing is okay. If everybody in the country smokes, then they're going to pass laws that smoking is fine. It should be done everywhere. In fact, that's the way it was not so many years ago. That if you wanted to have a smoke in the middle of a crowded bus, nobody could tell you you can't smoke. It's your right as American. You're free to be able to puff, you know, your cigarette. Nobody else has to smoke. You're allowing yourself to be free. But people are complaining they're choking on your smoke. But now we've decided that smoking isn't good for us, and it isn't good for anybody. And now if you want to smoke, you got to go somewhere where you can't bother anybody with your own smoke. And so we see that what's right and what's wrong is like the stock market. One day it changes one way, one day it changes another day. And this is why humanism falls on its face after a while. It can't make any hard lines anywhere. And there's no absolute authority to base anything on. So this is why there's different levels of atheism. Or materialism, we could call it that. I was interested to find out a few days ago, I was looking on the internet, that there's this, you know, Wikipedia, probably all of you have heard of it, and they have these little segments, and now there's a Wikipedia page for what's called irreligion. They call it that. I didn't call it that. The Wikipedia people didn't think of it. The people who think it's cool called that. They call it irreligion. Under that is atheism and humanism and behaviorism and naturalism. It's, in other words, all the atheists in various flavors all together on one page explaining, you know, the importance and the benefits of various kinds of atheistic outlooks in life. So that kind of also fits in with the chapter today. Any other questions? There are none so powerful and happy as I. I shall perform sacrifices. I shall give some charity. And thus I shall rejoice. In this way, persons are deluded by ignorance. This is the sort of archetypal mindset of someone who is really kind of down there with the gung-ho atheists. You know. People who are atheistic, what are their main goals? Power, wealth, sex. Those are basically that's what they're interested in. So the more power, the more wealth, the more sex I can have, the better off I am. And that's what they think of 24/7, is increasing all those three things. Their amount of power, their amount of wealth, their amount of sexual contact. All these things are absolutely important to a demoniac person, and as we heard earlier, that the demoniac person doesn't even really care that much how they get those things, whether it's legal or not, whether it's moral or not, whether it steps on somebody else or not. When you get past a certain threshold in, you know, the flavors of demoniac or materialistic understanding, all those things no longer matter. All that matters is how much wealth you have, how much power and influence you have, how much prestige you have, and how much sex you can possibly garner. So that's what makes a difference. And I really like this little soliloquy here. Krishna's just kind of thrown it in there. I wonder if it's almost comic relief sometimes. it sounds funny, but it's so on, you know, as far as... We can see people who could easily say these words and not flinch, you know, and not say them with a ironic or a sarcastic tone in their voice, you know.
All right. So next up. So perplexed by various anxieties and bound by the network of illusions, they become too strongly attached to sense enjoyment and fall down into hell.
Mm-hmm. Fun place.
Self-complacent and always impudent.
Impudent.
Impudent, yeah. Deluded by wealth and false prestige, they sometimes proudly perform sacrifices in name only without following any rules or regulations.
Now here's a thing that oftentimes people don't understand or recognize, that many times demoniac people externally appear or want to appear as if they are moral or even religious. But it's all a show. They have no real substance to it. And sometimes the demoniac people actually know that, and they don't care. They just want to appear to follow the styles of people around them. But they really have their own interests at heart. They aren't seriously following any kind of regulation. They just want to appear to be doing what's socially or historically correct. It's explained that later in Kali Yuga, after the age of Golden Age of Lord Chaitanya, all religion will be reduced to external show only. There won't be any genuine religion going on basically in the world. That all religion will be just symbols and external shows, rituals with no real purpose, and people will still do them, but it'll just be kind of a little game we play with ourselves. That any reality or any depth of the religion will be edited out. So that it'll be just people with it. And we see that there are places in the world that already that's happening. And, there are high priests of some kinds. They're basically, what are they really high priests of? Who knows? But they have some ritual, they have some tradition, they do it, and they consider things important. Those things may not actually be of any real value spiritually, but they're cute or they're interesting for their anthropological color or whatever it is, but they have no relevance to anything that opens the heart to a deeper level of reality. So I guess you're 18.
Bewildered by false ego, strength, pride, lust, and anger, the demons become envious of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is situated in their own bodies and in the bodies of others, and blaspheme against the real religion.
Yeah, we'll hear in the next chapter that religion, the mode of goodness, knows what is to be done and what is not to be done. Religion in the mode of passion is unsure what is to be done and what is not to be done. Religion in the mode of ignorance always does what should not be done and never does what should be done. In other words, it's completely backwards for religion. Mm-hmm. So we'll read about that in the next chapter, chapter 17. But we haven't got there yet. So we have 19 here. Those who are envious and mischievous, who are lowest among men, I perpetually cast in the ocean of material existence into various demoniac species of life.
Obtaining repeated birth amongst the species of demoniac life or son of Kunti, such persons can never approach me. Gradually they sink down to the most abominable type of
That means that the cycle of reincarnation is paying attention to what people do. They may not be paying attention to what they're doing, but the cycle of reincarnation is. And if you oppress others, you're in a leadership role and you misuse that leadership role. If you're misusing resources, if you're causing pain to others, that will certainly not go unnoticed. And as a result, you will be forced to go through hellish life in the hellish worlds for a period of time. It's not eternal, but you will go through a purification in hell, which certainly won't be pleasant. And then after that, you will get released into an animal or insect body and then have to gradually work your way up the ladder of insignificant creatures until you come back to the level of being a human, which may take millions of births. So we were talking about the other day that there are 8,400,000 species of life. 400,000 of those are human, so 8 million of them are non-human or subhuman. And So if you fall way down, you may have to go through zillions of years to actually come back to being a human again. And then when you come back to being a human again, there's a chance that you'll just make the same mistakes all over again, and back you go through the same cycle again. So that is the cycle of reincarnation.
That sounds tiring.
What's that?
Just the sound of that is tiring.
Yeah, I know. And of course, one of the things that I realized, you know, a few months ago we had the Rath Yatra in Manhattan every year, and for a short time I was asked to go to the question and answer rooms, and I did. And there was a lady who asked about, you know, what about Hurricane Sandy and all the people that died or had some, you know, issues there, and were they all sinful? How do I understand that? And there are episodes of mass karma. Just like an individual can do something wrong and get karma for it, so groups of people can do something wrong. And the group of people will experience as a group some kind of mass karma. So the way that manifests is not everybody in that group will be affected by the mass karma, but some people will be, as a message to those who don't get affected by it. So if there is a lot of materialism, a lot of sinful action, a lot of selfish action that causes pain to others, then some representation of the whole overall group will get the karma of the whole group. But in one sense, the karma table still balances, because the group that gets the karma, that actually gets the bad karma for the entire group, their karma is sped up. So they get their karma very quick in some devastating thing like Hurricane Sandy or some other catastrophe, Katrina, or some earthquake, or some airplane crashing into the ocean, or crashing into something else, or some other kind of disease or whatever it is, outbreak. And in this way, some smaller group out of the larger group gets the karma for the whole overall group. That's mass karma. Of course, the whole group deserved it. And those who didn't get the karmic version of the whole group, they will also get their karma, but it'll be in a slower way, and they may have to wait till they die to get it. Whereas those who got it in the right away, they get it, you know, in this lifetime, and in a very maybe horrible way. In a few moments, they die in some catastrophic and very painful, fearful way. And so it's intended to shock all the people in the group, thinking that, well, that could have been us because we identify with these other people. But we didn't get it, so I don't think we didn't get it because we were better. I think we didn't get it because we got lucky. But it isn't luck. It's a message to be sent to the entire group. You know, these things like a hurricane somewhere. And of course, in some places, we find that when there's a catastrophe, maybe some of the people in the catastrophe weren't sinful. In fact, they might even be saintly. But the reward for a sinful life is you die, you get sentenced, you go to hell, you become an animal or a plant or whatever it is, you work your way back up to human form. That's the so the worst thing that happens to somebody who's very sinful is they die and they have to go through all this atonement, all kinds of pain and suffering. Now, for a person who's very saintly, what is happens to them? They also die. But for them, death is released from the material body, and they may go back home to the body. So it's a good thing for them to die. And in either case, people are going to die. But death is the beginning of punishment for those who are very sinful. And it's actually the final reward for those who are very spiritual. They get released from the body, and they go on to a spiritual life. And in some great cosmic or some catastrophe like this, not everybody that dies is sinful. And most of the people who die in the catastrophe probably aren't any more sinful or less sinful than people outside. But that is sent as a message to all those people outside that you are doing something wrong. And these people got the brunt of the reaction. They got their karma sped up. Now they can go on to wherever they were going to go on to. Whereas the people who didn't get their karma sped up, they got a shock instead of an actual karmic reaction. They're still going to get their karma reaction, but it'll be slower, and maybe they'll wake up because of that message of a catastrophe. So this is part also of the karmic system, that we have divine justice. So if someone, like this lady asked, feels that because of catastrophe, that because of this catastrophe, I don't believe in God. But not only do you not believe in God, but you don't believe in justice either. Because unless there's a God, there can be no ultimate concept of justice. We know that human justice is sometimes works and sometimes goes misses the mark. You know? And human justice can only go so far. If someone causes thousands of people suffer and they die, then we may not even get the chance to give them justice. They just die, you know. So it appears that there is no justice in the world. And that certainly doesn't give anybody any kind of comfort. So if you reject God, and you reject reincarnation, and you reject the idea that there is a karma for what we did in the past coming to us, then essentially you have to also reject justice. And when you reject justice, that is a pretty heavy price. You will live in a world then that nothing makes any sense, and there is no justice, and people die and they go through miserable lives for absolutely no reason. And some people who are very cruel and selfish, they prosper, and they will never be taken to task for that. That's the world that you get when you give up the understanding of karma. That's the world you get when you give up the understanding of God. That's the world you get when you give up the understanding that karma comes to us either fast or slow, sooner or later, one way or the other, it catches up to us. Unless, of course, we become a devotee, and then Krishna may write it off to some extent. Any questions about that? Steadfastness, meaning, you know, strong in your convictions, I guess, is what that's actually.
compassion for all living beings.
Compassion for all, yeah, that's an important one.
Simplicity.
What's that?
Simplicity.
Simplicity, right. Compassion for all living beings. Compassion for all living beings is a very important quality. And people who actually claim to be divine or claim to be trying to be in the category of divine should certainly try to develop this quality. Otherwise, we see all too often so-called religious people who are very sterile, harsh, and aloof, which is definitely not really a spiritual quality. It sort of underscores the idea that they're really not compassionate for all human beings. What are some qualities of demoniac people?
Pride.
Anger.
Greedy.
Arrogance.
Arrogance. What's arrogance?
It's feeling you're above what your actual position is.
Yeah.
You feel like you're really above.
And you carry yourself as if you're better than people around you. And you deal with people in a way that they feel that they're being manipulated or attacked. What's some other qualities? We talked about a lot of things.
Harshness,
yeah.
Conceit is like the same as arrogance, right?
It's similar. Arrogance is kind of an outward thing that you do to other people, whereas conceit is something internal that you actually have a false concept in your mind of. You think that you're very great. Of course, it translates into external behavior, so those two are quite clearly connected.
They're attached to the material world.
Right. See, that's what we mean by materialism. Atheism, materialism, they're the same things. That when you want matter, you're an atheist. When you're an atheist, you want matter. So what it means to be a materialist is not only that everything comes from matter and there's nothing beyond matter, but that matter is the only thing worth having, too. And that's what our life is focused around, getting more of those material things. So that's materialism. That's atheism. And I think that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls, what is it called? Jadavad. That's what he calls it. Yeah, Jadavad. So Jada means stone. And Vad means theory or philosophy. So philosophy of stone. You know, so in other words, matter is being exemplified by a stone. So there's, what did he call it? It's Jadavad. That's materialism, but it comes in many flavors, like we said a little while ago. That it comes in Svadananda Jadavad. That's what it was. Svadananda. That I should be happy in materialism. And then there's Nisvadananda Jadavad, which is that, well, other people should be happy too when I'm happy in materialism. So these are two flavors of atheism, or two flavors of materialism. And so one is a little lighter flavor than the other. But Buddhism is in a completely different category. I forget how he categorizes that. I don't know in Sanskrit, but it's starting to come back. I haven't written the top of your head for a while. But we kind of get an idea of how these philosophies actually play out. That these philosophies are not new philosophies, but they get, like, at a smorgasbord, just combined in different ways. You know, if you have maybe 10 preparations at a smorgasbord, you've got a fruit salad, you've got a punch, you've got a main course, some kind of vegetables, pretend it's vegan or vegetarian, and you've got some kind of salad. So you can take the salad, but not the punch, and skip on the potatoes and take the main course. Or maybe you skip the main course, you only take the punch, and you only take the rice. And so that's the way it is. That these philosophies have been around since forever, philosophers just mix it slightly in a different way. And to people who don't know better, it appears like a philosophy. But because these philosophies actually are disconnected from the original tradition of the Vedas, the Bhakti tradition, then there's something a little off with them all. And most of them are seriously off because they start with the idea that matter is the source of everything and matter is the most important thing. And that's why we call it materialism or atheism. Of course, actually, Buddhism, although it's not materialism, is certainly atheism. It's a form of non-atheistic materialism. Because Buddhism considers that there is no matter, so therefore we can't be materialists if we don't even believe in matter. But at the same time, we don't believe in God either, so we're certainly atheistic. At least what I usually call literary Buddhism. Most Buddhists actually don't think that way. But they're not literary Buddhists. They're mostly practical Buddhists, at least in the Orient. They have a philosophy that's quite similar to devotion, but they just call it Buddhism. And that's kind of an amusing sort of reality that I read about with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and then when I spent time in the Orient, I found that that's actually true. So many people in the Orient, if you just took the statue of Buddha and replaced it with Krishna, they would do exactly the same thing that we do. And you wouldn't be able to know that they were Buddhist. You would think it was a Krishna temple. Temple? Yeah, there's Zen Buddhists. That's a whole different ball of wax. You know?
So, I was wondering, those Buddhists that you said, like, if you put Krishna there, it would be, like, the same thing.
Yeah.
Are they still, like, a... Because Prabhupada says, he mentions, like, the non-devotional Buddhist sects.
Yeah, yeah.
So, does that
That's
mean...
what he means by devotional Buddhist sect.
That what he means... So, Now, are they regarding Buddha? Like, do they know that Buddha is like an incarnation of Krishna, or are they?
No. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that he once talked to a Buddhist monk from Myanmar, and he asked the monk, "What is Buddha?" And the Buddhist monk replied, "This is how Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes." The Buddhist monk replied, "The Buddha is God, and we worship him and try to serve him, so we go to where he lives, and we can serve him eternally there." And Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that what the Buddhist monk didn't realize was he wasn't describing his religion, he was describing our religion, but he was calling it Buddhism. And he said obviously he'd never read any Buddhist books. So this was Bhaktivinoda Thakur writing, you know, back in the beginning of the 19th century, you know. So, and I have actually seen, you know, we used to, when we were in Korea, sometimes we would have to start the day and do what we were doing, fundraising, before we finished our japa. So in the middle of the day, I would take my break and finish my japa. And the best place to chant japa was in Buddhist temples, because you could go in there and you could chant back and forth, and nobody would pay any attention to you, because that's what the Buddhists were doing too. And they would just think, oh, you're just a Buddhist doing regular Buddhist stuff. So you didn't stick out, and it didn't cause any issues. And plus, it was a nice atmosphere. There's usually incense, you know. And that's when I would see old ladies come in, and they would look at the Buddha, and they would, as they call it in Chinese, Chu Dao, what do they call it? Su Miao, yeah. Yo, wo Chu Dao Su Miao Pai Pai, you know. So, Pai Pai means to worship in Chinese, you know. So, when they swing the incense, they do exactly the same thing we do. And they would go to the temple, and you know, they would bring fruits and flowers and offer it to the Buddha, and they would offer incense. It's the same thing that an Indian lady somewhere in Bengal would do, except that instead of Krishna Murti, it's a Buddha Murti. And like the monk was saying, they have identically the same concept, that they're serving Buddha to try to please Buddha so they can go to where he lives. And this is actually Vaishnavism, but they don't know it. And this is technically called Mahayana Buddhism, which is the great vehicle. And many Mahayana Buddhists actually have this concept that they're serving Buddha the way we think we're serving Krishna. And so there's nothing wrong with that. But there is non-Mahayana Buddhism, which is the Theravada Buddhism or the Hinayana school, which is completely different from that. And that's the Buddhist school you only read about in the books. You never read about the other school because they don't write books. But the Mahayana school, they just do their stuff. You know? But the ones who write the books are always the Zen and the Theravada school, which believe there is no soul, there is no God, and that what we have to do is recognize that everything is illusion, and that even we don't exist, that we will one day come to the grand conclusion that nothing exists, and that's the ultimate goal of Buddhism. And if you can wrap your mind around that, I have to take my hat off. You know, it's so weird and so contra to anything human beings actually think. But there's still another school called the Vajrayana school of Buddhism, which is a Tibetan school, which mixes Tantra, which is an Indian thing, with Buddhism, and that's a whole weird ball of wax right there. I think the Dalai Lama is. He's Vajrayana.
With the Mahayanas, What's the destination of a very serious devotee of Lord Buddha?
Well, they'll probably get to go to where Buddha, who is an incarnation, Shaktivesha incarnation Krishna. So likely by appreciating and serving Buddha, they will either go to Vaikuntha or go to the planet where Buddha is, and from there on they'll go to Vaikuntha, because it sounds to me like it's just a hair off from what the Vaishnava tradition really states. Well, if you're actually serving Jesus in the sense of wanting to do whatever he says and giving your life to him, I think certainly you go to the spiritual world. There's no doubt about it. However, most people don't serve Jesus in that mode. Rather, they serve Jesus thinking that by being pious and living in this world, I'll go to heaven and I will enjoy there. And certainly there's some chance that that will happen. But of course, usually people eat meat and they do a whole host of other sinful things. So the chance of them going directly to heaven is not very great. But and most Buddhists should be vegetarian, but most of them aren't. So that's another factor in the Buddhist thing.
Yeah, most of them are.
What's that?
Is it most of Buddhists are not vegetarian?
Yeah, most of them eat meat. I was surprised to find that out too.
Like, the only difference I see my Buddhist friends is that they act like you said, they eat meat and they think, they say things like they're God, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we don't say those things. So it's a little, for me, it's a little exactly to say I'm God. I mean, there's definitely part of that in my heart that I'm.
Well, it's surprising. That's some strange form of Buddhism, because most Buddhists don't believe in God. So it's Mayavadis that say they're God, but not Buddhists. Usually Buddhists say there is no such thing as God. We are an illusion, and we need to overcome that illusion by the Eightfold Noble Path. And it's right action, right work, and all those kind of things. And by following the Eightfold Noble Path, we can be promoted to the Pure Land. But that's, again, Pure Land Buddhism. And when you're promoted to the Pure Land, there you can meditate properly. And when you meditate properly in the Pure Land, you will realize you don't exist and nothing else does. And if you want, at the last moment, you can become a bodhisattva and come back to the earth plane and help other people. Or you can just cease to exist, whichever you like to do. So there's a lot of schools of Buddhism, but, you know, I'm surprised to hear that Buddhists think that they're God, because that's a Mayavada thing.
Mayavads always say that, but Buddhists usually don't say that.
The question in those schools.
And then he said, Patanjali said that Buddha didn't write really anything, so like a lot of his
followers. Just like Jesus, when Buddha came, Jesus never wrote anything down, and Buddha never wrote anything down. And when they decided to actually think, hey, maybe we should actually write some of this stuff down, who knows what it'll be like a few years from now, nobody's going to remember any of this stuff. So, like Jesus, they didn't get around to it until a whole bunch of years had gone by. Of course, some people wrote stuff down while Jesus was still alive and while Buddha was still alive, but not many. And after some time, it becomes hard to figure out who really got it right and who didn't. If somebody lived and now we know that they died 100 years ago, how much do we really know about that person? Even if people did write stuff down, were they accurate? Were they coming up with stories? Did they have their own spin on it in some kind of way? And this was the problem that both the writers of the New Testament and the Buddhist Jings, they both had this same problem, that nothing got wrote down at the time. Lord Chaitanya also didn't write anything down except for 8 verses, but Krishnadas Kaviraj and the Goswamis, they were alive at the time of Krishnadas Kaviraj, and they wrote a whole bunch of stuff, so they actually saw it, and they wrote about what they saw, and so it's a little more right on. Of course, we even have one better than that. When Prabhupada came, people took videos of it and everything. That. So you can actually, even if you never met Prabhupada, you can hear him speak, you can see what he says, how he gestures, and all that kind of stuff. It's locked into camera form. And Prabhupada had this huge volume of books that he produced, which explained what he thought about practically everything from A to Z. So it's not hard to understand what Prabhupada was up to if you actually look at his books. Which is curious that Buddha, one of his main themes was to stop animal slaughter, and only a short time after Buddha left do we find that Buddhists kind of give up that concept of observing a vegetarian diet. There are a few Buddhists in the world who were really, really strong vegetarians, the ones in Taiwan. They are really militant vegetarians. They're strong on the idea of vegetarianism, and they go to a lot of trouble to create vegetarian restaurants and to do promotional campaigns to get people to become vegetarians. But in Japan and in Korea and in mainland China, there are hardly any Buddhists left in mainland China because the communist government was so antagonistic to them. But in Japan and Korea, all the Buddhist monks eat meat like anything. You know, they have no
meat. Was Buddha the vegetarian?
As far as I know, he was, because obviously he was pushing that philosophy of ahimsa, nonviolence. That's what he objected to in the Vedas. That if the Vedas say that you have to kill animals to perform sacrifices, then I don't believe in the Vedas. So it would have been two-faced for him to say that and then eat meat himself. His main theme was ahimsa or nonviolence. But how other Buddhists after him twisted that around and made it okay, I'm not exactly clear how that happened, but somehow it happened. But there is obvious evidence that there are certain classes or certain groups of Buddhists that still today maintain that Buddha did teach a vegetarian diet. They still themselves observe a vegetarian diet, though most Buddhist groups these days don't. They've slipped from that.
So very interesting.
Yeah, the Japanese Buddhists, they all eat meat. I was surprised when we went to Thailand. One time we visited a Buddhist monastery in Thailand, and we went there, and they do this Vipassana meditation where everybody sits down and meditates. And people come from Australia, people come from Europe, people come from Canada, people come from America, people come from South America, to engage in this, you know, Vipassana retreat. And when they're there, they meditate. And when they take their break, the Buddhists make food for them. And the Buddhists make vegetarian food for all the people that come. But the Buddhists themselves go off where they eat meat. Which is, you know, very strange. Yeah. It's very bizarre that in their own retreat, in their own program, they make vegetarian food for the people that come from outside, but they themselves eat meat. The Thai Buddhists are really serious Buddhists. Of course, Thailand is a really hellish meat-eating country. Some countries, basically, it's like they really feel like they have to catch up and eat as much meat as the rest of the world has. They got left out, so they have to catch up, you know.
Poor people are really poor. They can't eat a lot
That's
of meat.
That's right, yeah.
Which is kind of like a blessing.
It's
they
a blessing in
disguise. They sleep in light. But then as they get more rich, then they start
yeah,
to...
Yeah. Which shows another thing, that when you get money and you don't know what to do with it, you immediately start to bring yourself down. My parents were basically vegetarian until my father got a good job with the United States Department of Agriculture and started to make more money. Then we started eating all kinds of meat. So.
As much as you want it. I went to a place today because I didn't take my lunch, and I had a salad with like something, and the lady said, well, you don't eat meat. I said, no. I'm like, but you see, you have to eat meat, especially if you drink, because it absorbs the
toxins.
The toxins. So I said, well, I don't drink. She will go end the conversation. So one takes you to the other.
Yeah. Proper system. If you drink a lot of alcohol, you have to eat meat. And so these things work together, that if you engage in one sinful activity, there's a good chance you'll start engaging in the others.
Thank you for passing.
So, divine and demoniac natures, chapter 16. And next week we'll talk about three gates leading to hell, and we'll talk about why bad things happen to good people. The age-old question that you see on the internet. By the way, there's some Prasad over there.
Riverbank Farm.